Hello and welcome back. This is LinuxInstalled.net, episode number 110, recorded Tuesday, May 12th, 2014. Browsing the web in a terminal? No, really, it works. In this week's show, we'll talk about learning Flask, how Walt uses the Lynx web browser even to connect to modern websites today, and why. And Brian talks about why we should try CoreOS and Docker and what we can use it for. That and more on this week's show, so check it out. But before we get to the show, we want to remind you to follow us on Twitter, check out our Google Plus community, and of course, rate us wherever you find fine podcasts. If you give us a 5-star rating, we'll actually personally thank you on the episode following that. Thanks a lot, folks. Let's get on with the show. You've reached the LinuxInstalled.net podcast, and my name is Brian Wagner, and with me tonight is Mr. Walt Jivic.
Hello. See, the reality is I wasn't here last week, and they all just decided now it's my turn to fill in the gap, you know?
It's your turn to have to put up with me, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Sorry. You drew the short straw. What's up, Walt? We haven't talked to you for a few weeks.
This is true. What have I been doing? So, after my Ubuntu updates of many weeks ago, I believe I had mentioned I had a couple of Kubuntu machines and a few Zubuntu that had upgraded, and I ended up liking that enough that I reinstalled Clean on my work computer, the that used to be a Kubuntu 1204, to Zubuntu, and it went just fine. But one of the cool things, and I know you guys talked about it a little bit last week, but I'm going to mention it again, is just how awesome it is to have your home folder on a separate partition.
Uh-huh.
Because unlike pretty much any other OS out there in the world, you just reinstall, say, oh, yep, I need Firefox. Oh, there's all my stuff. Oh, yep, install the SSH server. Oh, all my keys just work. Oh, there's my whatever. And it's basically like you didn't even do anything.
It's a whole lot faster. A whole lot faster. Having recently had to reinstall Windows machines, where you can't really do that. I mean, you could, I guess. So other than that happiness, was there anything else?
It's just the usual. I've been, where I work, they block a lot of stuff. And I've been remoting home, you know, via SSH to my Linux server to do whatever it is that I want to play with at that particular point in time. So I've been little by little grabbing snippets of coolness for different things you could do in console. So I don't have to SSH forward, which is ridiculously slow due to my upstream. And one of the cool things that I've actually gotten working pretty well for most stuff that I need to do anyways is the old Lynx browser.
What? Wait a minute. You're using a text-based browser
to yes.
do what?
Search for stuff. Text. It actually works very well.
Does the internet work with just text?
Well, it depends where you go. If you're reading news, if you're searching Google, if you're using, you know, like database index search pages, if you're reading forums with certain themes enabled, it actually works a whole heck of a lot better than you would think. You even got mouse support. So if I do a full screen SSH window, which on my monitor ends up being a 1280 by 1024, I don't get any weird word wrap for the most part. All the different forms and fields, I can actually click in with the mouse and then type. Drop-down lists and everything populate just fine. So most of the things that I would need to do from home, more or less, is just text-based interfaces that would automate either downloads or web page configurations that are all just text stuff, and it's been working really good. So that's kind of a little maybe underutilized tool that although it's been around forever, still has some value.
So I just did a search because I was curious. Does Lynx have JavaScript support?
That's a good question. There are a couple of versions of Lynx out there.
Ah.
I'm using just the plain Lynx, which to the best of my knowledge is still the old vanilla build. But there are some that have graphics capabilities. There are some that allow for some plugins. But for what I've been using it for, I didn't need any of those. Because there's a links two, and then there's some other links dash, you know, Okay. Various.
Well, I just mean, like a lot of forums now have JavaScript in the back end to handle things like state dropdowns and
yes, and I think that
and stuff like that. So
yeah, that might have to do with as I mentioned, certain themes work better than others. And I've noticed a lot of the sites, I shouldn't say a lot of, but a good amount of the sites that I visit have been replacing their old Java menus with, I guess maybe it's HTML5, because I can actually navigate the menus.
Well, it's probably just they've learned how to write JavaScript so it fails properly.
Or that's possible too. I mean, they physically look different, so I really don't know what the back end is, but I did notice that as... you know, some of the, like the vBulletin in particular, as some of the forum upgrades have upgraded, I can actually navigate them now, where before I had to bookmark the direct link because I couldn't navigate through a menu.
Ah, okay. So,
it's old school. Yeah, it's got background downloaders. It's got, you know, multiple pages. It's works pretty good for what it is.
That's really cool. So, let's see. Is there anything else that you've been doing this week?
No, I was gonna try to give our network guys a little bit of a fit because you had posted a link and I should have looked it up ahead of time for that web page load server test. I think it was on Linux Journal.
Yeah, the Siege.
Yeah, Siege. There you go. That's what it was. And I was reading about that and I was like, ooh, that sounds like something I want to do. But with my luck, it would probably flag some sort of denial of service, whatever, and shut all my stuff down. And I didn't feel like dealing with that today. So
it probably won't flag an IDS because it's going to look like legitimate traffic. It's just going to look like a lot of it,
which I might not want either, since most of my machines are more or less rogue.
I would say they will notice that your bandwidth usage on those machines will go up possibly enough for you to be noticed.
Right.
Just given the segment you're on versus, you know, if you were sitting in a dorm room, probably not noticed, but sitting in your office, you're probably going to be noticed.
Yeah. Yeah. That's usually how I've gotten flagged for stuff in the past, is where it's like, oh, look, somebody downloaded 20 gigs today. Whose machine is that? Huh, what's Walt working on?
I see. Yeah, Siege looked like an interesting project or a product to do basically command line level perf testing, performance testing. Basically, you're going to lay siege to your server and try and push it as hard as you can.
Yep.
I don't know how well that, I mean, if you just want raw load, if you're doing APIs, it probably wouldn't be a big deal. If you're trying to load test an actual GUI interface from the command line, don't know. But I think it was really more for backend testing APIs and JSON, you know, stuff that's going to return JSON, easily parsable stuff, but
yeah,
still lets you put a huge load on the server.
Yeah, in the article, I guess they ran, was it Sean Powers? I think he ran it against his Raspberry Pi, which, you know, definitely taxed the hardware, but it didn't lock up on him. So I thought that was pretty impressive.
Yeah. So, cool.
How about you? What have you been doing this week?
I passed my CISSP exam.
Yay!
I don't know that there was much doubt I was going to pass, but I mean, I had already passed it once. But it was one of those weird things. I went to go take the test, and I was fine. I'm like, you know, I got this. I did the practice test, scoring easily high enough to pass. I'm not worried about it at all because it's a pass-fail test. You either pass it or you fail it because the questions are so random. You couldn't really compare two people on the same scale because there's thousands and thousands of questions that could be asked. So, and you only get 250. So No way to really match people up. So either you've got enough to pass or you didn't. And I got enough to pass. But the morning I was fine all the way up until 2 or 3 hours before I was supposed to go take the test. And then I had a panic attack. It was just like totally freaking out. Am I really ready?
Yeah.
Am I ready? Like so much so I was debating having a beer before I left just to calm myself down. So I like wouldn't freak out and fail just because I was so freaked out.
Hey, it worked at college.
It did, but this was a little more professional. So I decided that was probably not prudent.
And officially, I guess it didn't really work in college either. For either of us.
Not really, no. Nope, nope. But that was a lack of studying. This was not a lack of studying. This was just pure nerves. And then I didn't remember it taking me this long the last time. I had 6 hours to take the test. It actually took me 4 hours.
Oh, wow.
It was really warm in the room, and that might have also been my nerves. But I was having trouble. The questions are pretty boring. Like, you know, you're answering a lot of security questions. The CISSP is probably the toughest exam I've taken for a certification, but it's because it's such a broad base of stuff. You have to know everything from the legal requirements for security stuff. You have to know physical security. You have to know OS level security. You have to know application security. Yeah. There's 10 total domains. I can't remember all of them right off the top of my head now. But you have to know like from 10 different focus areas around security. So you have to have a very well-rounded knowledge of security when you get done. Now, luckily for me, my job has entailed dealing with security since the beginning. So, and I've had mostly corporate jobs even as a consultant. So I have to deal with people that have these concerns legally or otherwise. So I've had to learn all this stuff for my day job. So it's not tremendously hard for me to learn it. Some stuff that I don't deal with all the time is what I was studying though. Sure. Just to go back and it's like, I haven't had to read a contract in a long time. Let me go look at this again. Or actually contract's a bad example because I've read enough of those, but, I had to go kept mixing up different types of flood attacks. So I had to go reread those, memorize those again, and refresh myself on the complete OSI model, not just the parts that I remember for regurgitation on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of stuff.
Wonderful. Learn all this stuff that you'll probably never use except for once when you're taking the test.
Yeah, you'll take the test. There's like four parts you got to know. Four layers you really have to know, and the rest of them you can forget.
Yeah. That was the worst part of like even basically studying for anything is A, you got to learn it the way they want, not maybe even necessarily how it works in the real world, and B, you're lucky to use 20% of whatever it is.
When you're done.
When you're done, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then there's other classes where I don't even think I've used 1%.
Yeah.
But, you know, my father had 2 master's degrees, one in chemistry, one in business. And when I was studying, I think it was differentiating equations and stuff like that. It's like, yeah, I've never differentiated an equation since I left school.
Right.
25 years doing chemistry work in the real world, never needed to differentiate an equation.
Yep. Say the closest thing I might have used is trig when I was playing pool.
He's like, for work, he's like, I don't think I've ever used anything other than algebra, maybe some geometry trigs type stuff occasionally, but he goes, for the most part, no. Just to figure out volume would be the only thing he would be using, which he goes, which kind of you learn in algebra anyway. So, you know, it's just a formula.
Yeah.
He said, as long as you know how to do a formula, you're pretty much okay.
Well, as long as you can use Google, you're pretty much okay.
No, yeah. My kids have it so easy.
I laugh all the time. You know,
You know what's hilarious is? I will ask my 14-year-old daughter, she will ask me a question, and it's something that's just like really annoyingly easy. And I know if she just goes and types it into Google, she'll find it. And so she'll ask me, and I'll look at her and go, did you look on Google? Well, no, I'm coming to ask you. Right. Go look it up on Google.
Right. Because that's really all I'm going to do.
She's like, well, how do I do that? www.google.com and type in your question. Really? I thought we went over this before, but yes, really.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
And their natural language detection is getting better and better every time I actually just type in a question. Like if I just type in converting kilowatts to amps, you know, like how many or volt amps or whatever. Mm-hmm. It is. But doing that conversion, I can never remember how to do it. I always have to look it up. And I can type it in, and I don't think there's a Google Now card for it, but you know, it takes me straight to all the calculators. Like it knows exactly what I'm looking for, and it just goes, here's the calculators. Which one do you want? You click on it, you go. I use it all the time to convert odd set. For some reason lately, I've hit a couple of spots where people have used quantities of seconds that I'm not used to. Like it's not 4 days, 2 days, 3 days, you know, the numbers that I've got memorized over the years. It's just really odd numbers. Like the one was 5.5 weeks in seconds. And I forget what that was, but it was a really large number. I was like,
Really? Why didn't you just switch to minutes or hours? Because it was dead on like a specific number of hours when it converted to hours and minute or you know to minutes, to
yeah,
hours and all that stuff.
That was probably the lowest base value that whatever that code could run. So they just they did all multiples of that.
So, yes.
Yeah, that's hilarious. Dude, if I had Google when I was in school, I might have finished. That's basically what I laugh about all the time.
I don't know if that would help.
I might have gotten more homework done.
Well, sure, because you would only have to start like 20 minutes before you had to go to class because you have to search for everything on Google.
Yeah, I laugh all the time. Same thing, you know, we get the interns. And, you know, mm-hmm. they'll be working on some code, and they're like, oh, how do you program this? And I was like, you go to Google, and it spits out the code for you, and you paste it in, and you're done. You know, back in the day, I had to sit in the cube with, like, five other guys, and if we were lucky, we were managed to figure it out.
Yeah. Well, and then if you were the ones, or one of the ones that could figure it out, because in my first programming class, there was me and, like, three others that could actually program. Because I had done BASIC before college, so I had some clue as to what we were trying to do. I wasn't great at it because it was Pascal and it was on the freaking mainframe.
Ooh, but, yes.
You know,
parallel Pascal.
And, yeah, that's the other thing my children will never experience is going to a computer lab, sitting with a bunch of other geeks until all hours of the night trying to figure shit out. Because there'd just be no reason to go there because you just do it in your room.
Why do I have 5,000 errors in this COBOL program? One line, semicolon, fixes them all.
How am I getting 400 errors when I only wrote 100 lines of code?
Right. Yep, good times.
Don't understand. So I passed my exam and played with some other stuff. I'm also learning Flask because I'm frustrated with Django.
I don't even know what that is.
Try Flask. It's just another, they call it a micro framework. It's actually a really light, easy to use framework. It doesn't have a lot of bells and whistles, but it does a lot. It doesn't do, the nice thing about the Django is that it has an object relational mapper, so you don't have to worry about the SQL on the backside.
Mm-hmm.
So with Flask, you kind of have to know a little bit about SQL just to create the schemas, and then it does most of the heavy lifting after that. But it's cool. It's tremendously powerful.
Yeah, I was going to say, what's the benefit to that then?
What's the benefit? I'm only trying to do a really simple application, so I don't have to do a lot of the setup stuff you kind of have to do with Django.
Gotcha.
So it's super, super simple. Like, it's like five lines to write the Hello World server, web server. So I will put a link to that.
Yeah, that's cool.
In here. Flask. And we'll have that in the show notes because that's what I'm doing right now is putting it in the show notes. Other than that, I've been studying and working.
Mostly I see working. You're still 8-bit.
I am still 8-bit. I did try to figure this out a little bit and then I got tired of messing with it and went off to something else. And magically, I was online gaming with some friends. We were doing some Marvel role playing on Saturday night and up until I screwed up and locked up my Chrome session into the Hangout, I was beautiful, high-res, normal Brian. And then I restarted Chrome and ended up restarting my browser. And when I restarted Chrome, I was back to 8-bit. So I don't know what fixed it, and I don't know what broke it again. And
that's really weird.
Still working on trying to figure out if I have all the packages correctly installed. Because for some reason, it's just not detecting the scammer correctly. Because it doesn't – I forget what does – huh. It says laptop integrated webcam. That's its name.
Okay.
And it's detecting another camera, which is no longer plugged in, which is funny. Which I guess we'll play with later. See if that works any better. So my camera woes continue. I'll have to see if I can get something better to work over the next week. But my audio still sounds okay, so I'm just rolling with it.
Yeah, because I noticed last week, obviously, is when it started, and I thought maybe it was a kernel update, where they updated some drivers, and it's either being detected wrong or one of those you got to blacklist the internal and actually load an older one for an older, camera firmware or some craziness like that.
Yeah, and I haven't spent enough time working on it to say that there isn't a fix out there, and there probably is. I mean, it took me a really long time to find that stupid fix for Crash Plan, which was just dumb. But it made sense afterwards. But, you know, I had to add a line to the configuration for Crash Plan just to get it to boot.
Yeah, that's also weird.
So, you know what else that I wanted to talk about?
Nope.
Fine. Oh, you already talked about that too. Anyways, Core OS and Docker. So there's a new distribution called Core OS, or newish distribution. I don't think it's that new, but people are making it sound like it's new. So maybe it is. Maybe I was mistaken. Called Core OS, and Core OS is an ultra lean distribution designed strictly to connect you or to allow you to run Docker. And so, I don't know if you weren't on last week. So nope. After we finished the show last week, Greg and I were talking, and I messed up last week. I was thinking I was going to mention this, but I didn't. So I wanted to put this note in here to remind myself to talk about it. So Core OS is a base OS that you can install Docker on top of, and it's supposed to be super lightweight. Core OS also has additional features built in, like built-in clustering configurations and all that other stuff, so that you can easily cluster Core OS instances so that you can run Docker across multiple Core OS instances easily, efficiently, and without a whole lot of effort, so that you can create highly redundant applications using Core OS and Docker. And they're not tied together. They're not similar or even connected projects. They're just one was developed supposedly to support the other. So Core OS was developed to support Docker.
Okay.
So going through all this stuff, and I've been trying to figure out, because I am a solutions/enterprise architect, so I have to think about these things in case I get asked by a customer, what would I use Docker for? And so I've been going through the whole thing. I'm like, I don't understand why I wouldn't. For a long time, I've been going, I don't understand why I wouldn't just use a virtualization software. I really don't understand. And then the situation where I decided I would choose this over a traditional virtual machine is either A, in a development situation where a developer needs to have multiple versions of, say, Java or Java virtual machines. So while it's possible to install WebSphere 7 and WebSphere 8 next to each other, it's a royal pain in the butt to make sure that they're not cross-grabbing libraries and other stuff, which could cause you problems or make features not appear because they weren't in the other version. If you did them in Docker instances, then you wouldn't have to have two virtual machines. You wouldn't have to have a 7 virtual machine and an 8 virtual machine. You could have both on the same virtual machine, and then you could test either way. You could test your code either way because they could both look at the same repository.
Right.
So you could go, okay, look at this repo. Both instances look at this repo. You put them on different ports. If you go to 8000, it's one. If you go to 8080, it's a different, it's the other instance. And then you can pull your app up in two browsers and all your rest of your configuration could be the same. And they'll be completely isolated from each other. So you don't have to worry about any cross-contamination from the other version.
Yeah, that's true.
And I was like, okay, that's one good, really, really good use.
That is. Yeah, I totally agree with it.
Now, the other really good reason I thought of for using it, and this is the one I've heard people talk about, but I couldn't figure out why it really made sense if you're anything larger than a startup. And the reason I couldn't really get my head around it was the thought was you would build the stack, the full stack, the database, the caching, the queuing, whatever technologies they're going to use, each would be a Docker instance, and you start it up. When I did something similar, I installed a management for Docker application called Shipyard. It does this. It sets up everything in its own container. Then you can go back and you only have to update the container that you need to update, right? So if it's the Redis container, I only have to update Redis. If it's the MySQL container, I only have to update MySQL if I'm just updating MySQL. And I only have to restart that. Not that I would have to normally for, yeah, that's just a restart. But when you're restarting it, you're actually restarting the whole OS. So it has some inherent advantages that nothing could be cached for the instance itself. So you eliminate some of those issues.
True.
The other thing that I saw, the other big reason that I saw for using Docker in that situation was I can collapse that down from, or I can start for a developer with that full stack. So they have a, not necessarily production level, but you know, they have a workable version of Redis, MySQL. Let's say they're doing Tomcat and Apache or Nginx. So they got all four of those pieces installed on their machine. They're all separate instances. If they, for instance, write some bad code and inadvertently throw themselves into an infinite loop, which takes over the Tomcat instance, The only thing they have to restart is Tomcat. But sometimes, you know, you have to do a lot of killing and other stuff at the OS level if something like Tomcat runs away with itself, because it may not be listening for commands.
True.
Because the container is around the instance, you can just tell the container to turn itself off
and kill the container. Just
completely ignore
right.
everything in it. So it'd be a little easier for them to manage. They don't have to learn all the kill commands and all that other stuff. They can just go in and say, shut it down. Okay, that's a good use. But because now you can take those same instances, assuming that you're storing the data outside the container, you can take those instances and move them up through to production. That same container can go all the way up and get all the way to production. And when it gets to production, then it's connecting to production data. Life is wonderful. And then you can scale it out because you can take the parts that need to be separated because they're using too much CPU or they're using too much RAM, and you can pull them off onto their own virtual machines and still have all that cohesiveness because all the connections and everything it knows about each other.
Right. They're separate to begin with.
They're separate to begin with, so it's not, you're not adding any complexity by doing it any differently.
Hmm.
So
that's pretty good.
Those were my two big points on when and why to use Docker. And I was thinking about it because I kept saying, I don't see where an enterprise would want to use this, until I came up with actually the one that convinced me that if you're a Linux shop and you're an enterprise, you should look at Docker. The one thing that convinced me was the thought process through installing separate versions or even fix packs of WebSphere, WebLogic, Tomcat. If you're going to apply that fix, tell your developer to go pull down another Docker instance, a second, you know, just go pull the latest that runs next to the current, and then they can just point the, you know, as long as the disks are set up to point to the same spot, you can sit there and say, okay, try your code on this and make sure that it works. And the developer doesn't have to do any configuration or setup. They just download it and run it.
Yeah.
So
would this be beneficial with to help with dependency applications as well? So, you know, if you want to upgrade your Apache and it needs, you know, some other various applications upgraded, but another software that you're running still needs to keep it on that older version because you have a Docker instance, you could actually run your upgrade on Apache and it doesn't affect your other application until it gets the newer version that also needs the newer dependency.
Correct. That would be another good example. Multiple versions of anything that has cross dependencies with anything else.
Yep.
So you need to upgrade to the latest and greatest version of Apache. Ubuntu doesn't support it yet, but you're going to go ahead and download and compile it anyways. Well, that means you also need these other libraries. And well, if, you know, in a traditional virtual machine, you could mess stuff up because you're changing all that stuff.
Right.
It lets you isolate it out. So it's just Apache that gets affected. Now, that doesn't mean that if it affects the PHP code, that would also affect Apache. I mean, Apache's changes and PHP changes are kind of locked together. You couldn't separate those out. But if you were using something like Python or Java or Perl, anything where you're running a separate server that runs the application code, that could easily be separated. And then you could separate concerns and issues. And then you just have to worry about that in the containers. So.
Right.
Yeah.
And I guess my other question then is how much more optimized is CoreOS versus running Docker on like Red Hat?
I haven't tried it out yet, so I can't say for sure. Let me check the article real quick. I mean,
from the CoreOS webpage, it makes it looks like it's a lot better. But I mean, in a world of not infinite resources, but obviously, you know, much more readily available, you know, how much OS could it actually save you? Or is it more of a convenience thing where it's just kind of the best case platform to install Docker to without having to tweak the core OS to make it, you know, better integrated or better compatible?
What we were talking before about Ubuntu and Mint and all those, they install a bunch of packages for you, so there's a lot of stuff you don't have to do, which is where I suspect my image problem is there's some package that Mint installed that Xubuntu is not installing or Ubuntu Studio is not installing, so I'm not getting the benefit of that package, and I just need to figure out what that is. CoreOS is similar to, there was JEOS from Ubuntu for a long time, which was built to run on virtual machines or as a virtual machine OS.
Mm-hmm.
So when you wanted to build a Ubuntu OS, you put JEOS on there, Bob's your uncle, it's all good. that version of Ubuntu was really only different in the packages that it installed, and there were no other differences besides the packages. So instead of where Ubuntu would install the whole X-windowing system and all the GNOME stuff and everything you needed for GUI, JEOS just installed all the OS basics without a graphical user interface. That was a big part of it, because that was the bulk of the difference that they saved in disk space, because that was their big thing. They were touting that you were going to save disk space for stuff you weren't going to use anyways on a server.
Right.
I don't know that they still, I didn't see that option when I was doing downloads for Ubuntu server anymore, so I'm not sure if they're still doing that. Because the server instance, I think now, just doesn't have the GUI. I think they just kind of combined it all. This Core OS is that same concept, except that it installs everything and is optimized to deliver the containers. So I would assume it's a very lightweight distribution without a lot of packages. There's probably not a graphical user interface, I would assume. And it's just lighter. Would it make it faster? It could if it had better drivers for the disk layering scheme that Docker is using.
Right.
So if they've taken the time to actually tweak it to make it beneficial for Docker, maybe it would work better.
Right. Or even if it's just easier because it's pre-tweaked. And right, for a novice or a developer who's not really into all that server configuration, it'd give them a better performance out of box.
But I'll be testing it this week just to see.
Cool.
I can't imagine how much. I mean, just straight Ubuntu is so fast. Until you're going to get into really heavy loads, I don't think you may not notice it. You probably won't notice it.
If
you're going to put this into a production environment where you're going to use CoreOS, then you need to test it with CoreOS outside of that environment. Does that make sense?
I mean, yeah, I'm used to optimized OSs for all like the ARM stuff that I do, you know, because you can't load full systems on something that's only got, you know, 128 meg or 64 meg of RAM. So that makes more sense. But at the server level, you're not going to be running on limited resource. You're going to be running on a decent machine, in theory. So
in theory, you're going to, I mean, not in theory, in reality, you're going to, at this point, a server with less than, I don't think they even sell servers with much less than 16 gigs of RAM.
Yep.
As a general rule. And it's usually, if you buy the server, like if you go into the Dell website or the HP website and you start pricing out a server, very quickly, you start to realize that RAM's not the most expensive until you get to something crazy. But generally, 32, 64 gigs of RAM at this point in a server is so commonplace that it's the kind of sweet spot. You have to play with it. There's sweet spots for all of them. I think you're right. But if it'll let you give the applications more memory, you might be better off. Because I had Java instances that were running at their full 1.5 gig of memory per instance. So the more of those I could run on a physical machine, the better, the less hardware I had to buy. They weren't CPU intensive. They were just memory hogs.
Yep. Oh yeah. I've run into that already on some of my projects. Java's a pig, which sucks.
Yep.
Yes. I'm sure if Greg was here, he'd have some colorful comment.
Yes, he would. So I think that's it for this week, unless you get something else, Walt.
No, I think that's about going to do it.
All right. So don't forget to follow us on the Twitters. We're at Linux Install. We have a great going community over at Google Plus at linuxinstall.net. Or we're plus linuxinstall.net. And then check out everything that Walt's doing over at geovec.com. And my other site is DevOps Mastery, where I'm talking about all kinds of DevOps stuff. So what should everybody go do, Walt?
Go and install some Linux.
Have fun, everybody. Talk to you next week.
See ya.
This has been a production of LinuxInstall.net. All original content produced in this podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License. Please feel free to redistribute it to your friends.